You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, a De Vuelta a España, in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 19. Today we are in Toledo.
Days later, I walked into Toledo.
Here we go.
I'd found a brilliant white inn just inside the city gate, so dazzling it seemed to be carved from salt, but the bruising impact it made on the eyes soon warned me that something was wrong. I remember climbing into the town, hugging the narrow shadows and accompanied by rainbow hallucinations, then staggering into a wine shop for a glass of water and dropping unconscious on the floor. Hello, Daniel.
Again, Richard Moore again.
No, that is Laurie Lee. As I walked out one midsummer morning, his memoir of travelling around Spain, and he actually fell ill until he'd done that. That's sort of appropriate because I've fallen ill. I am ill. I've got a horrible cough and stuff. Lionel's ill. That's why he's not here. He's been vomiting. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Always fine. I'm bulletproof. Well, I am.
Where was that? Rodez. We remember Rodez.
When was that? What happened?
A couple of years ago?
Yeah, I was ill, but I still kept working. Absolutely.
And what am I doing here? Titanium. I'm working hard here. So Toledo, yeah. Well, here we are in the home of Federico Bahamontes, who was on the podium, 91 years old.
Home of El Greco.
El Greco, yeah. Well, old Laurie Lee went to see El Greco when
painter,
he was here.
Sculpture.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful city. Have you been here before?
No.
What do you think?
It is very beautiful. I look forward to having a good look tomorrow in the morning because it's a relatively late start, although we're quite a long way from the start. But I don't know about you, Rich, but we were very late getting to the finish today. There was terrible traffic around Madrid, so we only made it to the finish about 15 minutes before the race actually came into Toledo.
Yeah, it was horrendous. The Madrid Ring Road, wasn't it? Crossing the Sierra was not just a stage on my journey, Daniel, in spite of the physical barrier. It was also one of those sudden, jerky advances in life, which once made closes the past forever. It was a frontier for me in more ways than one, and not till I'd passed it did I really feel involved in Spain.
Talking of frontiers, I had another unconfirmed report of another unconfirmed foray into Portugal for the Vuelta a España today.
Teo Gegenhardt.
Teo Gegenhardt was convinced that the Vuelta went into Portugal last year, but again, I've looked at the maps and this is a fairly dubious report.
Well, it was a good stage today, wasn't it? I mean, there was a lot went on, a bit of beef as well at the end.
A lot of beef.
And a bit of Argentinian steak on display at the finish as well. Poor Max Riccese. Didn't have much clothing left and his bottom, frankly, looked in a pretty bad state. So, it didn't look good, but it was a nasty crash. There's been some more footage of the crash that took out Tony Martin from the race and brought down Primož Roglič and caused some drama. We'll talk about that in a moment. But in this episode, I want to bring your attention to an interview we've got later on with Willie Smit, the South African on Katusha Alpecin. It's quite amazing interview. He's had quite an incredible life, and we'll hear from him in some length a bit later on. But here we are, stage 19 to Toledo. Last hosted a stage finish here in 2010 when Philippe Gilbert won, and he was one of the favourites once again today. A break went pretty early on. Sylvain Dillier was there. Remy Cavagna was there. Lawson Craddock was there for EF Education First. Scabu Gourmet from Mitchison Scott. He's been on the attack a lot. He was there. Ben O'Connor. He's been up the road a lot as well. Nicholas Arndt, former stage winner, of course. Shane Archbold was there as well. And then he dropped back for some reason. And we wondered whether that was tactical because he's an important teammate for Sam Bennett at Bora Hansgrohe. I spoke to Shane Archbold at the finish. Well, not here at the interview because he wasn't that happy, but he just wasn't going well enough to be in the break, and he kind of got there by accident, so he dropped back. The break got a good lead, and you know, it looked like they might fight it out until there was this crash really, and that was about 65 kilometers to go.
Correct.
It happened actually right at the front of the bunch. A rider slipped on the wet roads going down a descent, and Tony Martin sort of somersaulted over him. He was the worst hurt, along with Max Riccese. But a lot of the Jumbo-Visma riders were caught out. And in the kind of confusion after that, the race entered a sort of plateau with a bit of wind. Not as much wind as the other day, but a bit of wind. And Movistar went to the front and really drilled it for about 15 kilometres. A group of about 30 or 40 But, you know, it was a very controversial move that got people talking, criticizing them later on. After about 15 kilometers, Alejandro Valverde ordered them to stop driving it, and that group kind of, well, the Roglic chasing group came back, and everybody was back together. Miguel Angel Lopez was one of the other ones who was caught behind Superman. And in the end, Remy Cavagna, the young Frenchman on De Koenig Quickstep, who attacks a lot, he had a go with about 25 kilometers left from that break of 14 or so riders. A long way to go on your own, especially in these kind of windy conditions and with the climb up to the finish. But actually, it was a pretty good move given the riders they had behind De Koenig Quickstep. So he held off the chasers. Craddock was one of the guys who tried to get up to him. So was Nikias Arndt. Who's that, Daniel? You seen someone that you know?
It's Rob from EF Education.
Oh, so it is. What's he doing here? Friend of the podcast. Who else was up in that move with Lawson Craddock and Nikias Arndt? Oh, it was Bruno Armirai.
Correct.
From Groupama FDJ. Not seen a lot of them this Vuelta, have we?
Very inexperienced team, but Armirai has actually ridden quite a good race. He's been quite prominent. Promising rider.
So is Cavagna, and he held off the flying bunch, really, to win. Head of Sam Bennett, who rode extremely well and powerfully up that climb, which is quite a hard finish, with Philippe Gilbert third and Zdeněk Stybar fourth. So three De Koenig Quickstep riders in the top four, and no real changes to any of the jerseys.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with Cat. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thank you to Rafa, our title sponsor. And Rafa have quite a lot of things on during the World Championship week in Yorkshire around Harrogate. Have a look at rafa.cc for the menu of things that are on during that week up in Yorkshire, which is approaching fast. Daniel, the beef. Yes. We should get straight to the beef because that was the main talking point at the end of the day.
Let's not particularly tippy-tap around tapas. Let's get straight to the plateau principal.
Particularly strong words from Superman.
Yeah, Superman really let rip. You have these moments in press conferences and mixed zones when a rider will do that, and everyone is sort of starts salivating because you immediately know that you've got good quotes, a good story, and that was the case with Superman. He what tends to happen in the mixed zone is that there'll be, you know, they'll do one set of interviews and they'll move along a line to, you know, to the next seat, and Superman just kept reloading. And saying exactly the same thing, basically that the actions of Valverde were unbecoming of a world champion.
Shall I read the quote?
Go for it.
I think it was very bad of them, Movistar. A complete lack of respect with the red jersey and the rest of us. Around 20 riders or more were on the ground, and they always take advantage of this kind of moment. This isn't the first time. We have already seen in other moments and in other races that they always behave like idiots. It is always the same people that do this kind of thing. That is their way of being, and we all know that they are like this. I want to see a day Movistar win a race with their heads held high. Wow.
Wow. Boom. Were you aware of this beef between Astana? Is it? I kind of feel that I should be aware of it, or more aware of it, and I wasn't until today.
Long-standing beef, you mean?
Well, those comments suggest that this is something that's often thrown at Movistar, which, frankly, I've not really noticed. But then I have seen people's reaction, and, you know, on social media, and a lot of people are sort of bringing up previous incidents. But there have also been times when Movistar have been on the wrong end of this kind of thing. I spoke to their direct sportive Jose Luis Arrieta afterwards, and he made that point that today there was no barrage as well, which meant that Primoz Roglic could kind of get in the slipstream of the cars, and so could Superman, and consequently limit their losses. But Arrieta was making the point that in the past, Movistar have been, as I say, the victim of this kind of thing, and there has been a barrage, and they've not been able to get back up to the peloton. So I don't know, Rich. Part of me thinks that this was all to do with placement, and it's a skill to be in the right place. It's strategy as well to be in the right place at a point of the race when everyone knew, or the team seemed to know. We perhaps weren't aware of exactly where the crucial point was, but they seemed to all think that this was a crucial point, and that's probably why the crash happened, because it was a big fight for positions. You know, were the Movistar riders better prepared, in a better position than Superman and Roglic, and should they therefore be rewarded for that? I mean, just watching some
I don't know if you've seen this footage, Daniel, but this is some footage I've just seen of the crash. You see, it's the second rider in the bunch. I can't see who it is who hits the deck first. So the positioning argument is a bit, it's not really, it
it's
wasn't
a bit
really,
spurious, isn't it? Yeah. And I do also think that attacking the leader, the guy in the leader's jersey, after he's been involved in a crash, that's almost the last sort of sacred cow of the unwritten code of honour in professional cycling. You know, a lot of things have fallen by the wayside over the years, and you know, sometimes in the past we've felt the etiquette and the calls for riders to sort of respect and adhere to this etiquette have been a little bit pedantic and a little bit over the top. But I do feel that that is the one sort of last bastion of, you know, this kind of chivalry that, that has existed. There's no doubt it has existed in professional cycling. One thing that really did strike me was that there was no sort of senior figure. Where was Fabian Cancellara, you know, riding up?
He's retired.
I thought he would appear. I thought he'd come out of retirement, pop out of the commissaire's car at that point, ride up to the front of the bunch and start ticking off and waving his finger at Valverde. But that wasn't the case.
There's some suggestion that Gilbert...
Well, I spoke to him at the finish and he said that wasn't the case.
Mm. It's one of those things where you could almost see the riders behind Movistar, you know, maybe shaking their heads in a virtue signaling sort of way, while also thinking, this is pretty good, you know, this kind of works for me. And I you know, that's maybe unfair, but I don't know. It's
but also I think it's the point that Lionel also often makes, that if you think about it, forget the morals and forget the ethics of it and the honour code. If you think about it purely from a strategic point of view, is it a bridge worth burning for the sake of, you know, what Movistar were going to get out of it? Is the juice worth the squeeze? You know, is it going to come back to haunt them in this race or in future races? And I just think that it was a battle probably not worth fighting. 60 kilometres from the end of a stage like that, and I think that had they gained time, had they gained a minute or 2 minutes and put Valverde back in a position to win the race, I think it would have been devalued without a doubt, and I just don't think it was worth it.
There's quite a lot to unpick there. I mean, Arrieta, when he said that when he noted that there wasn't a barrage, so the team cars were still behind the group, offering some help to riders coming back up, did he think there should have been a barrage at that point?
Well, the whole issue of when there isn't and isn't a barrage is a pretty contentious one, isn't it, Rich? And it's one that's not necessarily fully understood, certainly not by us, and I don't think it's always understood by the DSs and the riders in what circumstances one is applied or not. And often it's to do with safety, isn't it?
Yeah, Arrieta told television during the stage that because there was no barrage and the cars were still behind the group, that they didn't feel like they should slow down because there was a good chance here for the riders coming back to get back on. And he also said that the team are prepared to attack in the crosswinds before the stage. Now, you know, if they
did feel they should slow down.
They did. Well, they didn't.
That's why they slowed down eventually. Because they knew there was no barrage.
Right, yeah. So there was no point in pressing on with the cars behind the group and the riders able to get back that way. That makes sense. But had they just started riding on the front and then the crash had happened, then they would have been perfectly entitled to carry on.
I think so. You know, this issue of was the race on or not, you know, we've seen circumstances in the past when there's been a concerted move by a team which has almost provoked a crash or provoked an incident, or it's certainly been obvious that a team has attacked or accelerated and then subsequent to that, things have happened behind, and in that instance I think it's more ambiguous, it's more difficult, and I have more sympathy with the team that then continues its effort. In this case, for all that the riders and direct sportifs were talking about the tension coming into that point of the race, it wasn't obvious that Movistar had launched some kind of offensive. I think they were positioning themselves for what they thought was going to be a key point in a few kilometers time, but so were Jumbo Visma and so were Astana.
I think Movistar, they did know that Roglic had come down or been held up by the crash, because, you know, the roads were open after that point, after that descent with the corner. The roads were pretty open. They could look around and see the group was 30 or so and that Roglic wasn't there, and there had just been a big crash. So I don't buy the argument that they didn't know that Roglic had been caught up in the crash.
The Arsene Wenger argument.
Anger argument. Well, listen, Daniel, at the finish, I spoke to Tim DeClercq of De Koonen Quickstep, always such an important rider for them, of course, about the another win for the team, you know, what their plan had been, and the Movistar tactics.
Another great day for the team, though.
Yes, first the plan was to ride for Phil and Stevie. In the end, Remy went into the break. It was a little bit difficult for our tactic, what we had to do then, because he was strong, but there were also some other strong guys. But then we said to him that it was better not to pull all day. In the end, he's very strong, and if he didn't pull, he got the resources in him to win, so it was perfect. And also behind, we had still Stibby and Phil, so it was perfect.
He's obviously a strong rider. We've seen him on the attack a lot in this Vuelta. He seems to be riding very well.
I think he's one of our the strongest guys on for sure on the flat. He's incredible. He has so much leg speed. So yeah, it was just waiting in the beginning of his career. Maybe he was not the smartest rider, but now in the team they. Yeah, they have a really good way of handling him, and now you see the results are coming, and it won't be his last victory like this, I think.
We saw you in the front group after the crash, which involved Roglic. What did you think when Movistar began driving?
If they were already riding before, I would understand, but really riding, if the leader's on the ground, on a moment there was no racing before, for me personally, it's something I would not rather not do, but yeah.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Thanks to Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting our Vuelta coverage to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by the community. Let's hear from Jens, one of the three co-founders of Lacca, about their model of insurance.
From the outset, we wanted to create a better way for cyclists to insure their bikes and gear. When we looked at traditional insurance, it got clear that insurance is a fantastic business model for the shareholder, but not the customer. With Lacca, we created a simple community-based model for bicycle insurance. We help our members when their bike is damaged or stolen and share the cost at the end of the month with the community. For every claim, we charge a small fee to the community. This way, the community is directly rewarded for taking care, and we only make money when we really need it. It helps us to really focus on you as a cyclist and when you need our help the most.
If you want to check out Lacca and perhaps sign up to cover your bikes and equipment, go to lacca.co.uk. That's Lacca, spelled L-A-K-A. Lacca covers your bikes and equipment for theft and damage at home and abroad, and even covers you for sportives and races, as long as you're not a professional rider. Lacca says that to cover around £2,000 worth of gear, it should cost about £8 per month, with fees capped, so that you should never pay more than £17 a month for that level of cover. So if that sounds like the sort of insurance you'd like, check out Lacca at lacca.co.uk.
Well, Daniel, this morning I went and spoke to a guy who I've been wanting to speak to properly the whole Vuelta, and I was going to see him on the second rest day, but their hotel was changed at the last minute, the day before they were due to stay in their hotel. It was changed 50 kilometres away from Burgos, so they were moved at the last minute. Katusha Alpecin, that is. The rider is Willie Smit, South African rider. It's his second year with Katusha Alpecin, second year in the World Tour. Yeah, Willie Smit was involved in that big crash into Oviedo and really suffered a terrible injury to his knee, a very deep gash. So we heard from him in an earlier podcast, and it wasn't clear at all then that he would be able to finish the race. But here he is, still in it, and he's got an interesting backstory. I was alerted to this by a very good piece in Pro Cycling Magazine last year by Sophie Hercombe. It was really beautifully written piece, actually, about his life growing up in South Africa and how he managed to get himself into the World Tour. So I've been keen to speak to him. But you told me something tonight, Daniel, that I didn't know.
Well, he's a 2 handicapper at golf, supposedly.
Really?
Yes.
Extraordinary.
And I think he had designs on a career in golf up until about his 16th birthday, much like myself, Rich.
Well, you didn't. Did you make it to 16? Had you not packed it in by
no,
then?
No, I kind of packed it in when I was about 13, 14, packed it in. I mean, I kept my hand in.
You can still swing a club, can't you? Anyway, so I spoke to Willie Smit this morning, and well, here's some of his life story.
I mean, I've been interested to speak to you since I read a fantastic piece in Pro Cycling Magazine last year, I think it was, about your life and the journey that you have been on to get to this level. It's quite a story. I mean, growing up in South Africa, you didn't have the easiest of childhoods, did you? You were brought up by your grandparents?
Yeah, so basically I was living with my mom. She was an alcoholic at the time. And then child custody took me away from her, put me into the care of my grandparents. It was big court cases. And then she said, no, she's fixed her life. So I went back there while my father was working in Afghanistan lifting landmines. They were never married as well, so it made it more complicated. Eventually I went back to my mother, but I wasn't attending school as much, and the community I was in, I was obviously involved with bad friends. But I don't want to see it that way. I just see it as uneducated friends, and then you kind of follow each other. You know, it's like chicken follows the other chicken. Again, child custody took me away, and from there on, I started living with my grandparents. I actually got to see my father, met him, and then shortly after he was back to Afghanistan where he passed away, which was actually very sad for my grandparents because it was the only son out of five children. They got really depressed, and my grandmother actually had no illnesses, and she picked up Parkinson's from there on, which was sad for her in a way, and it's not nice to see them that way as well. And then at the same time, my mom's, you know, she's been alcoholic for 30 years, so she's not changing her ways, and there's not much she can do for. And then it's been tough because she stopped speaking to me as well in that period after a while, because you grow apart as well, and it's just life. And we lived on the farm, so my grandparents will never replace my real parents. You don't have that connection with your grandparents as a normal. They were very strict but very good for me, and supported literally everything, especially cycling, because it was expensive. You know, I mean, buy a frame, always a new group set, and as a junior you also crash a lot and break a lot of stuff. And then they said, well, you need to have good marks to go to university. So it was a lot of pressure in between that and getting good enough marks to study a law degree, which I then pursued and tried. I had to live in the hostel, which made it also much more complicated because you have to follow their rules, and you know, you've got this whole what do they call it, PT, or I don't know what it is, where you have to go with the groups and they kick your door open at 4 in the morning, and it's part of being in a hostel. To work through that, you know, studying enough and then trying to cycle, which completely didn't work. And then after about 3 years of studying, got through the 3 years, and then I got a contract in Nipo, Vini Fantini, which randomly just happened on Facebook when one of the agents contacted me. Went really well, and then I picked up fungal esophagitis, which kind of fucked up my 3-4 years of my career. And then, I just ran through the South Africa. That's also a long story on its own, but it was basically because of too much antibiotics. And seeing the wrong doctors every time you get a, you know, in university you pick up a lot of diseases and stuff like that. It's part of being a student. And then too much antibiotics caused the fungal esophagitis, which is like a fungi that grows in your lungs here.
You're cramming a lot in there.
I'm trying to get, to give a timeline. So then basically, it started, well, very average. We had really good program in Nipo Vini Fantini as a continental team back then, the year before they went pro-continental. But then that kind of ended my career for a bit. Then I ran through the South African teams for about 2 years before going to a really small French team. And then in 2017, I said, this is my last chance of becoming a professional, where I really changed a lot of things in my life, stayed really focused, and doors just opened from there as I went through a Spanish team. I lived with a Spanish family in Vigo, Galicia area, and luckily that manager knew the manager in Team Katusha, and my results were good enough, and they took me. So that's all the...
And we remember you from Bergen as well, the World Championships.
Yeah,
you put a very strong ride in there.
The thing that changed now is everyone is strong. Everyone can put in a strong ride. It's mostly about which teams you are in, because remember, there's a hierarchy and the bunch as well. I think you probably noticed it on the crosswind stage in stage 14. You get Jumbo Visma, Movistar that crosses the road, and the rest of us are on the back sitting in the wind, and it was just like a ticking time bomb where you get dropped. You can't go squeeze into the line of Movistar to get protected from the wind, because you've got the hierarchy and the GC, so And it's a lot of the time like that in bunch. That's why you rarely see those guys crash and everyone in the back crash. But the level is so high this year. Everyone is strong. And everyone's doing altitude training camps. Everyone's super skinny.
It's a tough sport. It sounds trite, but what has cycling done for you after the circumstances that you grew up in? Yeah. What's it done for you?
When I lived on the farm, there wasn't much else to do except ride my bike, which allowed me to go to different towns, see a lot of places, and meet a lot of new friends. And that's actually why I started. And it made me much more disciplined, gave me a purpose in life, because I'm sure if you have no purpose in life, especially us as men, our head, we won't be satisfied just sitting at home.
And you make these videos as well, and I gather you edit them yourself. The thing that makes them stand out, they're very upbeat and very sort of positive. Is that your mindset now?
I'm normally extremely positive. The bad thing with I would say Western guys like me is that we really get our mood is determined by the people around us. So if I'm not in a happy environment, it immediately affects my mood. I like to be at a table where people speak. Maybe it's an Australian-American type of thing. And that's a bad thing as well, because, you get affected by the people around you. And so if I'm in a good mood with good people, good staff like we have in the team, it's super nice.
And this is your first Grand Tour. And I know when you had this crash and this injury, you really feared that you wouldn't get through the next day.
Yeah.
You did get through the next day, and now we're just a couple of days from Madrid. How difficult have the last few days been?
No, the pain is I can handle now. The first 2 days was terrible. But the biggest problem is I'm forced to take antibiotics to prevent the infection, and that's killing me. I'm completely empty from that. We knew that was going to happen, but it's 2 days to go, and I still need to take it until Madrid. Otherwise, the team won't let me continue.
What would it mean to you, though, to get to Madrid?
I'm not exactly sure about the facts, but I think I'm one of two South Africans to have ever made it onto a World Tour team, not through a South African team or through South African support, which is, for me, an achievement in its own. And I've made it. I really had to fight for position on the squad. It wasn't planned 2 months before. It was basically just based purely on form, if you've got good enough condition to go. So that's another reason I didn't want to disappoint the guys. But also they're not forcing me to continue. And then like many people say, if it was their third Grand Tour, they probably would have abandoned. But it's my first one, so I think to finish it, it's a lot of things.
There's uncertainty around the team. What are your plans for next year? Do you know what you'll be doing next year?
We actually saw a tweet from some journalist on Twitter that said we're having a merger, and we've been informed yesterday. To be honest, no one has any clue what's going on, so I think that's complete bullshit. I've got a Pro Continental offer with a guarantee in a Vuelta a España start, which is nice, but obviously if I'm able to stay in the World Tour, that would be great. And I'm really hoping to join Team Dimension Data or NTT for next year. At the moment it's in the air, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed. It's home team. Well, but also I don't know what happens here, so there's a lot of good riders without contracts, so anything can happen. We saw it with Aqua Blue when a lot of their riders were only signed in November, December, so a lot can happen. But it is stressful and not nice for anyone involved, the staff especially. Yeah.
Well, that was Willie Smith, and what a story, and what a guy. And I recommend watching some of his videos on his YouTube channel if you get a chance. He edits them himself, as you mentioned there, and he's been doing them for quite a while, so it's quite a back catalogue to get through. They're very sweet, some of them. Daniel, he mentioned at the end there about the situation with Katusha Alpecin. Lots of rumours about mergers more than new sponsors. I was speaking to one of their members of staff earlier in the race who said that, they understood there were discussions going on with potential sponsors, but nothing concrete. There was a story that Willie Smith mentioned there that in the press this morning, or a journalist, I don't know who actually tweeted about a merger having been agreed, and the writers being told that's not the case, apparently. it doesn't look good for Katusha Alpecin, and they haven't done a lot of this Vuelta to sort of further their case for a new sponsor, have they?
No, they haven't, but I spoke to another rider this morning, Steph Crass, and he talked to me about the toll it's all the uncertainty has taken on the mood in the camp particularly. He said it's not been a good atmosphere. He made no bones about that whatsoever. You know, they've come here with a bit of a, I wouldn't say ragtag team, but certainly a team with very sort of mixed abilities or mixed sort of characteristics, and hoping to be opportunistic, but it hasn't quite worked for them yet, has it? You see guys like Batallin, who should have been, well, today's stage finish was absolutely perfect for him, and he hasn't really been a factor in the race.
He's another of the walking wounded, though, isn't he? He's got a lot of strapping on, and he seems to be in quite bad shape. It's not been great for them, and they've become a sort of a strange sort of identityless team in a way, haven't they? Having started off as the Russian Cycling Project, they've sort of lost that identity. If that was important to them in the first place.
Yeah, I think they have, and they sort of were decapitated in a way by Marcel Kittel's issues. Kittel's involvement, or Kittel's signing for the team, was very much connected to Alpecin's involvement with the team. And I think, had Kittel been a roaring success there, then we might now be sort of contemplating a different future for the team. Alpecin, as we know, are pulling out. I think they were probably open to the idea of a fairly long-term commitment to cycling had they had someone like Kittel as their standard bearer.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. Just at the checkout, use the code SISCP25. Before we go and refuel, Daniel.
Well, I was about to say, should we mention our meal last night?
Oh, yeah, we should.
It was probably the best meal of the world so far.
Yeah, without question.
Well, I'll mention the wine. We had a lovely Albarino from Riashbasha region, which is right in the northwest corner of Galicia.
It was delicious white wine. I had scallops. Well, I had a sardine ceviche to start with, served on
big slices of lime with like a ceviche foam on top of
foam. Yeah, it was delicious, and we had to eat these in a oneer. And then I had the scallops with a kind of with noodles, and what was the other? There was another fish in there, mussels actually mixed in with the noodles, which was it was
and
absolutely
as you said,
splendid.
Rich, it was nice, wasn't it?
It was very nice,
as you said at the time.
I started the day with a relaxing massage today. I treated myself to massage because all the driving has played havoc with my back, and I've been having a few back pains. So that was nice and relaxed. I think you were a little bit jealous of that, weren't you, Daniel?
Moving on.
Anyway, let's hear from our audio diarist. Well, I'm hoping we'll hear from both of them. As I speak, we haven't actually got James Knox's audio diary. I gather he was caught up in the crash today. But we do have birthday boy Nick Schultz. So what you hear now might be just Nick, or it might be Nick and James. I'm at the mercy of James Knox here.
It was also Sepp Kuss's birthday today. And I think
Rafał Majka's yesterday.
Oh, well, I think Nick Schultz and I might be wrong. Nick Schultz and Sepp Kuss might be the exact same age, which means they were born on the same day. What a coincidence!
Wow. That would make sense. Let's hear the rider diaries now.
Stage 19, done and dusted. One day closer to the end of this race. Never a dull moment. More wind today, more stress. Yeah, brake went pretty quick, but it sort of took a little while to be consolidated, and it was actually looking like it would just end up being a relaxed day, and the 10 guys that went away would go to the line, but a few teams came together and rode to control it. But there was just a lot of stress in the peloton today, a lot of nerves created by the strong winds that were blowing, and also the average weather that we were coming into in certain parts of the stage, with rain and slippery roads. And eventually there was a real massive pile up. A lot of guys came down. Poor old Noxie came down. Roglic came down. A lot of massive crash right at the front of the group, and then things really just split to bits. I'm not really sure what happened after that. The pace was lifted a lot in the at the front of the race, which was a little bit bizarre, but I guess it was at a point of the race where things could have gone down, and it just made for carnage for the rest of the day. I personally was feeling pretty bad today after a big day yesterday, and a pretty poor night's sleep last night. Sometimes after really hard days, when you're really fatigued, it's hard to sleep well, and I suffered a bit through the night last night, struggling to get some hours in, but that's part of Grand Tour racing, and it is what it is. It's just another one in the pocket today, and one really big day tomorrow before we get to promenade into Madrid. A lot of rain on the forecast tomorrow, so it will be a very interesting day, and I think it's all up to play for. Not much else to report on, really. It was my birthday today. I could think of a thousand other things that were better to do than be stressed on a bike in rain and wind. Yeah, it makes it all the sweeter when it's over. One person asked on Twitter if there'd be any cake or what cake there was. Well, we haven't quite got to dinner yet, so we'll see if the chef's prepared anything, but I'm not really expecting anything. And if there is a cake, I'm sure none of us will be eating too much of it with what's in store tomorrow. But yeah, thanks for listening.
Keep it quick tonight, stage 19. Yeah, not really what I was hoping for. A lot of stress. Some wet Spanish roads and lost my front wheel on a fast corner. Big crash, and obviously everyone saw what happened afterwards. Pretty disappointed, a bit embarrassed, very, very sore, but managed to finish the stage. Spent the evening in hospital, and then came back to celebrate with some champagne, which was, you know, a strange one. Trying to be happy, but struggling. Still an amazing team performance. I'm sure I could have saved a lot more in different circumstances, but yeah. Hope everyone is okay in the crash. It was pretty nasty. And then, yeah, it was a mess afterwards. I'm not sure if I'll be able to finish tomorrow. We'll see.
Now, our rider diaries, or diary. Both those riders, James and Nick, are shortlisted for Pedlar de Charme. They received a lot of nominations. So their diaries have obviously gone down well with you, the listeners. That's great. James is actually leading Pedlar de Charme at the moment, so he may well be going home with a Pedlar de Charme t-shirt as well. Any other business from today, Daniel?
Not really, no. Hang on a second.
We're doing an odd thing now, aren't we? We're basically, we came here today from Avia, and we're basically heading back there tomorrow.
I've got some other business. I looked high and low in vain this morning for Carlos Sastre, because I knew he would be there, because he's from Avila. And then I saw him at the last minute, just as the race was about to go. I was busy, I was off to do something else, so I couldn't speak to him, which was a bit of a shame.
We did see Federico Bahamontes, though, on the podium.
Oh, he was there, was he?
He was on the podium with Roglic. I wondered if Roglic knew, you know...
Rog doesn't strike me as a great student of the sport.
But they had a long chat on the podium. I mean, I think Bahamontes is quite a character, isn't he? Yeah. Quite a larger-than-life sort of character.
Absolutely.
He can talk. And at 91...
I think he would have been jealous of your massage this morning.
Really? Why?
Apparently quite a ladies man.
Oh, really? Well, anyway, he doesn't look his age. He looks very sprightly for 91. And there's a statue of him that we passed on our way up to the press room today, which I took some photos of.
This will be lost on you, Rich, but he reminds me, he's the kind of Gary Player of... Do you know, have you ever heard of Gary Player?
He's a golfer.
A South African golfer.
He's a golfer. He's
very much on message. Gary Player, you know, I think he does 1,000 sit-ups a day. He's about 78. He looks about 55. Bahamontes is kind of in that vein.
Right, well, let's go and find something to eat, shall we, in this beautiful town.
I haven't really done my homework on specialities in Toledo.
No? Well, let's do that now. Thanks very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.